All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We've got a very, very special episode of the podcast in your ears, on your phone, whatever. This is a couple of conversations that are really focused on the patients, and I'll get into the details of those in a moment. First, a little bit of housekeeping. I'm actually recording this on July 3rd. I'll be on vacation. I've been on vacation the week that you're receiving this. So we will not have a new Markers Newsmakers nothing that would refer to anything that happened this week, because I am up in Vermont living the life. So I'm really grateful to everyone who has been part of Device Talks throughout, but particularly the first half of 2025. And we look forward to bringing you many, many more cool things in the second half of 2025. So I hope you're all finding some time to enjoy with your family, be it at home or be it on a trip. We're just taking a short trip, first one we've taken in a while. So I hope you find some time to relax. Anyway, back to the podcast. We're going to kick this podcast off with an interview that our producer, Amira Weininger, did at Device Talks in Boston. She spoke with Heidi Dose. I've known Heidi for 5 years or so. We met early on in 2020. She's been just a good friend and a fantastic person. She has a unique story that Amira will unpack, but her focus has been primarily in the medtech industry. So she's also worked in the tech industry. She's worked at Google. She's working at Boston Scientific. But she's got a very strong patient focus, and you'll find out why in the conversation with Amira. And this episode, I think, really will sort of highlight the focus on patients, both broadly and also specifically, because in my conversation that follows, where I spoke with Ken Mariash, who's the CEO of Synaptica Therapeutics. Synaptica is developing a TMS neuro device that is showing some promise in stemming the losses brought on by Alzheimer's. And as I discuss in the conversation, my mom contracted Alzheimer's and started showing signs very early on. And it's a dreadful disease. And as Ken and I talked about it on and off the podcast, probably one of the more impactful and more horrible ways, things to be affected with. So not only for the person, but for the family. So I thought Synaptica's story was encouraging. I think their technology is showing promise. They've got some key elements that will help them move the business forward. So grateful to Ken for sharing his story, for sharing Synaptica's story. And of course, thanks also to Heidi Dose for being part of Device Talks Boston, where she led a kick butt panel on patient input on designs, and also, again, sat down with Amira Weininger. This entire episode is brought to you by InterPower. They're a very big provider of power supply components in medtech. So we're grateful to their support. And that's it. Before we kick things off, let me sell two things to you. When I'm back, we'll have our Interventional Innovations webinar series. We're going to have a conversation each and every day focused on different technologies on our virtual platform, the same platform from which we use Device Talks Tuesdays. Kayleen Brown will kick things off on Monday, and then we'll be hosting different conversations with, like, Ray Cohn, who's the former CEO of Axonics, of course, but he's led two renal innervation companies to acquisition. And I'll talk with Ray Cohen about the renal innervation space. So there's five in total. On Monday, we'll be talking about peripheral arterial disease with the CEO of Ephemeral Medical. On Tuesday, once again, I'll be talking with Ray Cohen. On Wednesday, I'll be speaking with Robert Chisina of ABS. On Thursday, folks who have listened to the podcast heard my conversation with Dan Lavangi, the CEO and chairman of Cerevasc, which has an amazing technology to help treat normal pressure hydrocephalus. So we'll talk about how that not only could treat that disease, but also could be used more broadly. And then on Friday, I'll be talking with the amazing Amar Sani, who is the creator of many companies and is founder of, and CEO of Instilla. And we'll be talking about rethinking vascular embolization with liquid and resorbable embolics. So all of these conversations are free. They're all available to you. You can just register for one and all. Go to devicetalks.com and be part of the conversation. You can watch live and get your questions asked answered right away, or watch on demand. We won't be able to take on demand questions, but you'll get to hear answers to other people's questions, but you might want to watch live. So go to devicetalks.com to register for our upcoming series. And we are beginning to post details about Device Talks West. It's going to be an amazing 2 days. We'll have our kickoff keynote, Tim Schmidt of Johnson & Johnson MedTech. Other keynotes, Josh Macauer of Stanford. Ray Cohen will be joining us there to talk more broadly about success in MedTech. Anna Zdwah, the CEO of Moon Surgical. We'll have Aman Jetty of Intuitive. And a panel that includes Yilong Wang, sort of the father of telesurgery, talking about the advances in telesurgery. Those are just the keynotes. We've got lots of other great track sessions going on. So make sure you go to west.devicetalks.com to register. Our early bird rate will be expiring in just a few weeks. So if you know you're coming and you want to save some money, don't wait to register. Go to devicetalks, or rather west.devicetalks.com. All right. Now let's get this podcast started.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Future of MedTech series. I am joined by Heidi Dose, founder of Torta Height. Heidi, it is a pleasure to have you here today. I'm really excited. This was an unexpected addition to our lineup, but I'm so happy to have you. And I'm just going to jump right in with, how did you find your way into MedTech to start with?
Boy, that's a loaded question. You know, my journey to MedTech was very different than probably most people that are attending this conference. I'm actually a patient and a technologist. So I started an internet company back in the 90s when people actually said, hey, the internet's a fad. No one's going to use that. Guess what? The internet was not a fad. And look where we are today. But that journey as a technologist is what got me the background to like getting into data, getting into like delivering technology solutions. But I also became a heart patient when I was a teenager. I had an AV ablation, and I've been 100% dependent on medical devices since 1983. Wow. So 40 plus years, I've been device dependent. And so I also chose to continue being an athlete. For me, this idea of how do I use the data as an athlete to understand what's going on in my heart, and then take those insights and have a better conversation with my doctors so I could tell them what it was I wanted the device to do. So fast forward, my personal life, my patient journey, and my professional life as a technologist brought me into the space of med tech. And now I wear a couple of hats. I am a patient advocate, but I'm also a technologist building AI platforms for medical device companies.
That is it. I will say it's not the first time I've heard this. So, but you're right. It is an unusual path into med tech, but what a valuable perspective, because I think that sometimes we in this industry, we're technologists, we're not patients. Yeah. we're doctors. There's a lot of physicians, practitioners. That's most trying to get to practitioners. There's a lot of practitioners, but not a lot of patients.
Correct.
And so that brings such a valuable perspective to add that voice, because ultimately that's who we want to serve. You have the perspective of an end user, and that makes
Correct.
That incredibly valuable. Yes.
So, and that was one of the topics that we discussed here at the conference, mm-hmm. is the value of bringing the patient voice into product development for medical devices. Because if you're building your device for your physician KOL, and that's easy, well, it's not easy, but it's comfortable, because that physician is going to bring a perspective that is knowledgeable, that's easy to distill the information that they're bringing and put it into feeding it back to your R&D team or, you know, how you your product processes. Talking to patients is hard. And yet medical device companies, the industry is all about, hey, we're patient-centric, but we don't want to talk to patients because it's hard, it's difficult. It's like, well, we'll the patient actually have something valuable to say, and can we prove an ROI that it was worth the effort to engage them? And I think with where we are today with digital health and this idea of patient-generated data with wearables, whether they're consumer wearables or wearables such as patches and things like that, that you can get this continuous data stream, all of a sudden, that pathway to engaging the patient and getting something meaningful and actionable from that engagement is a reality. So that's where I think things are getting really exciting.
That is so exciting. And so that was a perfect wrap up of like, where are we right now? Where are we today? And it's changing in a way that is really exciting. So now I want you to think a little bit bigger. Where do you see us in a year from now? And then maybe 10 years from now, what does this look like from a patient perspective, as you are able to speak to it from a medical device perspective? Where can we help each other make better products and ultimately serve patients better?
Right. So like I said, I've been on this journey as a patient for 40 years. And I mentioned that I started, you know, this internet thing early on when people said the internet's a fad, no one's going to use this. I've been giving talks on the future of healthcare and patient engagement and data transformation for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. Originally, I was told we're never going to use patient-generated data. Consumer wearables don't provide anything of worth. And look where we are now. You're asking the question of, hey, how do we use patient data? Where do we see it going? So, yes, it doesn't happen fast, but we are making headway. And so think about we've reached a point where technology and compute, just the actual ability to ingest and compute huge amounts of data is possible. So we needed to have that happen. Well, now we can generate lots of data. We can bring that consumer patient data, the medical grade data, the remote patient monitoring, and then the data that's generated by my device, bring that together in a data lake and now apply AI or algorithms, and you can have that actionable insight. Because the problem was, well, first we can create the data, but there's too much of it. It's all noise. Well, now we can bring that data together. We can provide, an algorithm or have a chat engagement with the data, depending on what stakeholder you are. And then you can have it reply with something that's very insightful, it's actionable, and now someone can do something with it. So if you're a physician, can you now provide better care more quickly to your patient population? If you're R&D for devices, can we now create some, alignment across different activities or something that the device is doing, and now we can do product improvement? And if you're a clinician and you're looking at clinical studies, something like that, a researcher, how do you now take that data and now you have more patient engagement and patient data in your clinical trials and have aha moments to say, well, we didn't expect this, but now here's something we can do, or now we can have a study around proving the efficacy.
I love this, because what I'm hearing you say is that as we're moving forward, as this technology advances, as AI is integrated to do the analytical side, we as stakeholders in the industry, as the medical device manufacturers, founders, as physicians, as practitioners, and as patients can work as a team. Mm-hmm. And we are able to take that analytics and outsource it in a way, but make those improvements so much faster. And to bring all of that together is just going to lead to better outcomes for everybody involved.
Well, and guess what else it does? So it actually allows us to expand the box. So when you think about a medical device and it's developed for a patient persona, and cardiovascular disease is a great example, there's a default persona of a 65 to 85 year old who's got an activity level of aggressive walking. I don't look like that person.
Right.
I'm a competitive athlete who also happens to be a heart patient. When you when you are able to start to look at the data and you find out that, okay, there's more people that fit in the outlier category than in the box category, let's collect the information. Let's identify a new persona or expand the box for who we are building. You now are building better products, better medical devices for a larger patient population, which then leads you to actually creating devices that your patients have the type of outcome they want.
Right, and personalizing and that.
Exactly.
And personalizing that for every single specific person.
It's like personalizing care at scale in a cost-effective way.
Oh, that is a beautiful future of medtech if I have ever heard one. So I can't wait to continue to see this, and we'll check back in and maybe next year and see, hey, what does this look like now? What has our answer changed? And we'll find out. So thank you so much for joining me today, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so very much for having me.
All right. Well, thanks again to Heidi Dose for joining us at Device Talks Boston, both on stage and in the studio. Thanks, of course, to Amira Weininger for that fantastic conversation. Now, let's start my keynote talk with Ken Mariosh of Synaptica Therapeutics. Well, Ken Mariosh, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. Glad to be here.
It's an interesting field you're in, an important one, looking for developing a treatment for Alzheimer's, of course, just a dreadful disease for anyone who's experienced it, and that's unfortunately a lot of folks. And I want to unpack that your story at Synaptica in a moment, but as folks know, we like to start off with our guest stories. Ken, how'd you find your way into the medtech industry?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for asking. You know, it started early. I was one of those lucky people who was struck immediately by the promise of bioengineered medicine, so to speak. When I was 16 years old, I remember I was in Mrs. Redmond's biology class, and I was enamored with this idea that genetic engineering was like the engineering of the human body. And so right then and there, I dedicated myself to the business of medicine, got myself some degrees in biochemistry and business economics. And then decided after doing a few years of consulting that I wanted to jump into industry. So jumped over to CSL, which is the Australian biotech juggernaut.
Uh-huh.
From CSL. Took some roles at Baxter, the bioscience unit that was developing hemophilia drugs, intravenous immune globulin, vaccines, biosurgical products, and so forth. And that was 20 years ago that we had our first phase 3 in Alzheimer's. So that was my first encounter, so to speak, with Alzheimer's disease. I had also seen it on a personal level with two grandparents. That was really devastating to see. And so there was already a personal interest in Alzheimer's at that point 20 years ago. You know, spoiler alert, the phase 3 failed at Baxter. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Mainly, we were chasing amyloid, which I'll get to in a minute. That's sort of, we've all kind of come to the realization now that amyloid is a key piece of the puzzle, but not the only piece. Anyway, after Baxter, I jumped to Boston Scientific, where I was tapped to start the strategy group for the nascent Neuromod division. At the time, the division was selling about $300 million in one geography with one product, spinal cord stimulation. And over the next 8 to 9 years, we launched deep brain stimulation. We acquired a number of products, including the Cosman franchise. I ran that franchise for a while, as well as doing all the strategic planning for the division as we scaled to about $1 billion in sales. At that point, I got the startup bug, you know, as many of us do. I jumped to my first startup and had a great experience there. I learned that the build side is a lot tougher than the buy side.
Uh-huh.
So I spent a good amount of time kind of, you know, wrestling with the dynamics of being in my first startup. And then saw the data from Synaptica come across, and I said, that's interesting. Wow. I've had two phase 3 experiences, one drug, one device before this. And the data was really interesting. I mean, it was across the board successful on every measure. And we're not talking about, you know, squishy made up endpoints. We're talking about the gold standard endpoints. So I was intrigued. And I said, that's interesting. I know neuromodulation really well. I know capital equipment sales from my Cosman experience. And then I also know Alzheimer's, having, you know, two phase 3s that I've been a part of in the past. And so all the stars were aligned, so to speak, for me to come aboard Synaptica. And that's how it started about 2 years ago.
All right. So let's go way back to the beginning. Were you envisioning a career on the bench, or did you always have the business bug? What was your direction?
I think I had to make sure that the bench was not where I wanted to be. So I spent a summer pipetting at a, at a company called Millennium Pharmaceuticals.
Sure.
So I wanted to just make sure once and for all that the science, the doing of the science wasn't where I wanted to be. And sure enough, that's what I found. The pace was just too slow. And also on the drug development side, you know, I was part of the biotech industry for quite a while. The pathways there are so fraught with risk. You know, the side effect profiles of some of the compounds that we're looking at basically gave us a 5-7% chance of success. I don't like those odds. So 10-year pathway with a 7% probability of success. I thought, you know, med tech is a little bit more straightforward. It's faster, you know, faster development timelines, a little bit lower PTRS, probability of technical and regulatory success. And so I kind of moved over to the device side from the biotech side.
Did the, you were at Baxter Bioscience. So that was the pharma side. You moved to the Boston Scientific Neuromod. Was it, is neuromodulation sort of a natural transition if you're on the biotech side? Is it sort of a familiar pathway, a familiar process?
No, not at all.
Could you have moved over to cardiac ablation or something else, or is there something specific about neuromodulation that sort of fit the profile you're looking for?
You know, the transition was not a normal one. A lot of folks move from drug to drug, biotech to pharma. That makes more sense. For me, transitioning from, you know, biotech and biopharma to device was a little bit of a change. There's different skill sets, different regulatory pathways, certainly different commercialization pathways and reimbursements, completely different animal. So I had to change a lot of my, you know, my orientation there. And I'm glad I did. Neuromodulation, I was not aware at the time, was this burgeoning industry, which at the time did not really have a lot of level one evidence. So over the next few years that I was there, a number of studies came out that were pretty definitive that spinal cord stimulation, for instance, works quite well to control various types of low back pain and other other types of pain. And then, of course, DBS for Parkinson's is now very well established. But at the time, it was still a little bit nascent as well. So we've seen a renaissance in general in terms of the neuromodulation industry. And depending on which products you include, it's now a $7 or more billion industry. But at the time, that was not obvious to me. I was enamored with this idea that you can direct electrical energy exactly to where it needs to be. Uh-huh. It's this highly precise approach. And if you think about the promise of personalized medicine, tailoring a therapy to the individual, we were already doing that in spinal cord stimulation. We were programming the device to fit that patient's pain patterns, which of course change and are very unique to the individual. Same with deep brain stimulation, involves a long programming session. And so that's something you don't see on the drug side. You can maybe tinker with the dose a little bit, but you don't really tailor the therapy, you know, the way that the promise of personalized medicine is always talked about in the cancer therapeutic space, for example. This idea that we're going to, you know, personalize cancer therapeutics, I remember talking about that 25 years ago, and now it's just starting to take place in various areas on the drug side. But on the device side and neuromodulation, we've been personalizing the therapy for a long time. And Synaptica is kind of the personalized medicine on steroids, because what we're doing is we're targeting the patient's brain networks that drive human memory. And so every, it may not surprise you, but every patient's brain responds differently to stimulation. And so learning what to stimulate and how to stimulate is really the key to unlocking a lot of the efficacy that we've seen in the Alzheimer's space with our therapy. And so it really is, as I call it, personalized medicine at the connectome level. And what do I mean by that? You know, the connectome is looking at how functional brain networks overlap. And it's all about how we can target those functional networks. You've got the dorsal attention network, you've got the salience network. And in our case, you've got the default mode network, which is where you integrate episodic memory. And so tailoring the therapy to your specific DMN in a way that personalizes the dose to be safe but effective, that really is personalized medicine.
I want to unpack those networks in a bit, but let's zoom back a bit and just talk about where we are in understanding how Alzheimer's can be treated. I mean, my mom developed it. She wasn't much older than me at this point, so it came young for her, and it was 30 years ago. And I'm thinking now, you know, I don't have a much greater understanding of where we are with research and treatment. And as you've noted, there's been a lot of high hopes and a lot of disappointments. Give us a sense of where we are today with research into treating, preventing I know we're diagnosing it better than we were before, but what's the state of treating Alzheimer's?
So the focus for the last 20 to 30 years has been on amyloid, which is kind of what we call the usual suspect. It's the obvious suspect. Now, amyloid definitely has a part to play in the disease pathology, but we're coming to find that it appears to be more of a covariant than a cause. And so I like to joke, although it's not so funny, that cleaning up amyloid is like cleaning up the ashes after the house is burned down. You know, there's a key role there for it to play. But if we could look upstream and look at other, you know, more central causes of the disease, you know, that would be better. Tau, the tau filaments appear to be a little bit more tightly correlated with disease progression, but tau is a tough target to drug against. And so we'll see if those bear fruit. So far, the anti-tau agents have not really been that successful. So be that as it may, you know, amyloid therapies have now been approved and they do exactly what they're supposed to do. They do clear amyloid. And yet the disease continues relentlessly, right? So there's got to be more to the disease state than amyloid. We're starting to look at the brain as being this very complex system. You think about, like, what is the cause of heart disease? There is no cause, right? It's multiple causes all compounding and working together to impact the functioning of the circulatory system. And so in the same way, we can think of the human brain as this exquisitely complex, delicately balanced network and system that if any one part of it is out of whack, it can actually drive other parts of the system to break down as well. And so now let's reverse this. If we were to correct different aberrant aspects of the network, could we also do the reverse? Could we stabilize the system? So think of a very complex engine like a V12 engine in a car. If you were to stabilize the firing of one cylinder, you could actually bring into stabilization other parts of the engine. So what we're trying to do at Synaptica is induce neuroplasticity. So what that means is by stimulating the right networks, we strengthen them. By strengthening the networks, we actually can reduce neuroinflammation, and we can also target other aspects of the disease process. And so we just had an MOA paper come out. It's a review paper in the Alzheimer's and Dementia Journal, which is the journal of the Alzheimer's Association, which goes into really exquisite detail on how this therapy actually works. You know, we've been looking at DBS for Parkinson's for 20 years, and we still don't know how it works. But here we're starting to develop a fundamental understanding of how TMS stimulation, when targeted to the right networks, can induce the right changes in the brain to stabilize the system. For instance, one effect of TMS stimulation is the upregulation of growth factors like BDNF, which lead to structural changes in the network. On the other side, you have functional changes to the network. The firing of the synapses can be modulated through the bioavailability of neurotransmitters and upregulation of neurotransmitter receptors like DR4. That changes the firing and strengthens the firing of the synapses. So at a structural and a functional level, you're modulating the networks and strengthening them by stimulating them. You know, my simple analogy is when you stimulate muscle, it strengthens. When you stimulate neurons, they strengthen as well. But now for the first time with this MOA paper, we go into really detailed looks at the cellular and molecular level and at a network level that show that what we're doing is we're stabilizing the system and strengthening it against the pathology of Alzheimer's.
That's amazing. How are you, I've got a lot of questions, including I want to get into the origin of the technology, but how are you measuring all of the success or the success that you're reporting in these papers? Is it done through CAT scans? I mean, how do you know that what you're doing is doing what you say it's doing?
Yeah, the FDA has very stringent requirements for the approval of drugs for Alzheimer's. So we now have global measures of dementia that have components that are functional and components that are cognitive. And so, for example, one endpoint that the FDA requires for drug approvals today is the CDR, the Clinical Dementia Rating Sum of Boxes. And so that's a multi-domain view of the patient's cognition and function related to dementia. On that measure, we have two phase twos that were successful on that as our primary endpoint. So our scientific co-founders wanted to design a randomized controlled study that used the right endpoints that pharma uses to make it, you know, as strong a study as possible. On the first phase two at 6 months, we were very successful in slowing the disease of Alzheimer's by pretty astounding amounts that I haven't seen from any drug today. Our second phase two was at 1 year. It did the same. It slowed the progression of the disease as measured by the CDR sum of boxes. And we've had many conversations with FDA on the acceptability of CDR-SB as a primary endpoint for our pivotal. We're also very successful in measuring functionality. So there's a gold standard endpoint called the ADCS-ADL. As the name implies, it's activities of daily living related to Alzheimer's. And on that measure, we slowed the disease by 87% at 1 year in a randomized controlled double-blind study, which has now been published in a peer-reviewed journal called Alzheimer's Research and Therapy. 87% slowing of the disease, let me put that into context. What that means for patients is for every year of stimulation, we're giving you back about 10 months of functionality. And if you think about what we care about as caregivers, and I've seen this up close, and I know you have too, what we care about is the ability of our loved one to feed themselves and bathe themselves, use a telephone and live independently. The worst day in the world, Tom, is when you have to put your loved one in a nursing facility. That is the absolute worst. There's another domain where we also show a benefit now. So not only cognition and function, but also behavior. So behavioral disturbances are some of the ugliest aspects of this disease. And you may have seen these with your mother. In my case, my grandmother became agitated and aggressive when dealing with my uncle. And so you think about it, you're dealing with a patient who doesn't recognize you, who may become agitated in your presence and may even become aggressive in your presence. On those measures now, we also have a benefit with our therapy. So we hit not only cognition and function, but also behavioral disturbances in Alzheimer's. So we hit the trifecta. All three domains are apparently benefiting from rTMS stimulation, as shown in this published peer-reviewed phase two study.
That's unbelievable. So what is the origin of the technology? Where does this come from? And was it initially developed for this purpose, or is it being redirected from another initial purpose?
Yeah, Tom, this is not the TMS that you're familiar with. This is TMS like you've never seen before. Here's the thing about TMS. It's a great way to stimulate the brain, but you're flying blind.
Yeah.
You don't really know what you're stimulating. They literally use a rule of thumb to estimate where the DLPFC is for depression. And that may be fine for, you know, generally getting in the right area of where you want to stimulate. So our scientific co-founders, Dr. Giacomo Koch and Emiliano Santarnecchi, they're at the University of Ferrara and the Santa Lucia Foundation and Harvard, respectively. They noticed that the precuneus is in the posterior parietal cortex, is a key piece of the DMN network. And so think of it as a central hub. And so they had this idea that if we could confirm that we're hitting the network and seeing the signal spread as we stimulate from the precuneus, seeing the evoked potentials travel through the known areas of the DMN, maybe we could confirm that we've hit the network, the right network and not the wrong network. And so what their amazing breakthrough invention was pairing TMS with EEG. Now, there's very few labs in the world that can do this because the energy that comes out of a TMS blast is several orders of magnitude more than the energy that a 64-channel EEG is listening at. But if you think about it, it's like active sonar. You're pulsing the brain with single pulses of blasts of energy, and then you're listening with EEG to see where those signals travel to. Now, in about 10 years it took them, they were able to deduce from the data coming back from TMS EEG the signals that confirm that we're hitting the right networks and not the wrong networks. And it turns out, like I said before, every brain responds pretty differently. So the optimal point of stimulation for the DMN for you might be centimeters away from where it is for me, and the dose for you might be twice what it is the dose for me. It is important in this field to calculate the right dose too, because you could overstimulate the patient. And these are patients with delicate brains. The Alzheimer's brain is known to have epileptiform activity, so you definitely don't want to overstimulate them. There's no way to measure the dose, so to speak, with TMS today, except looking for a thumb twitch. What does a thumb twitch have to do with the excitability of the brain? Very little, right? So what we're actually doing is we're measuring the very excitability of the DMN through 64-channel EEG. Again, combining TMS with EEG in real time to look at how those evoked potentials travel within the brain to confirm target engagement and to dial in a safe but effective dose. That's all patented. The idea of using TMS with EEG, that method is now patented by Synaptica, and it applies to any brain disease, not just Alzheimer's.
If you wouldn't mind, talk a bit about the default mode network, the DMN that you're referring to, and then networks in general. What is that? What does the construct look like on the brain? Is it just layers of connected neural pathways that sort of follow a course? Give me a visual.
So the brain is composed of multiple overlapping networks. We no longer think of, you know, regions in spatial domains of the brain as having to do with cognition. We think of large-scale distributed networks. So that's how we're thinking about the brain now. The default mode network is where your brain goes by default. Uh-huh. So when you're not engaged in an external task and you're just reflecting on the day or letting your mind wander wherever it will.
Taking a walk or whatever you're doing. It's just sort of the when your mind is quote unquote at rest, that's
when you're integrating memory. So yep. If you're engaged in an external task, that interrupts the DMN because your focus needs to be on whatever you're uh-huh. doing. But then later, that's when you integrate memory. So an analogy that I like to use that actually comes from a friend is a race car driver in Monaco. You know, you do this race, you have all these really like visually and auditorily impactful experiences, emotional experiences, you almost crash, you know, you remember, you know, the checkered flag at the end, you know, you remember lots of aspects of running this this race. But where that gets integrated is later that day when uh-huh. you're not engaged in the task. And as you go to sleep at night, of course, those are cemented down at your hippocampus. So that's how memory is consolidated. Now, the DMN has a fascinating role to play, not just in episodic memory, but also in terms of self-reference, my sense of self in the world, my sense of self in relation to my history. This is where we kind of form our internal narrative. It's fascinating. It might be going a little bit far to say this, but maybe not too far to say this is where we form our sense of self. Uh-huh. And interestingly, Alzheimer's patients often report in the initial parts of the disease, they will often say things like, I don't feel like myself. I'm just not me anymore. And now when I hear those words, and I've heard them from a couple of patients, they mean a lot more to me now. And I think about it in the context of the DMN. So the DMN is just this fascinating target, and it is most affected by Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a disease of memory. And so it shouldn't surprise you that's the network that goes down first. And we see DMN dysfunction 20 years before symptom onset. We also see that amyloid beta and tau tend to accumulate in the regions of the DMN. You have one node, which is the medial PFC, so the medial prefrontal cortex. The other node where we stimulate is the precuneus in the posterior parietal. You have the temporal parietal lobes as well, and the angular gyri, which are part of the network. And then the hippocampus is also part of the DMN. Now, we can access all those nodes of the network except the hippocampus through 64-channel EEG. So when I stimulate the precuneus and I see those signals travel to where I know the nodes of the DMN are, I know I've hit it. I'm being very simplistic, but our algorithms know how to clean the data. It's very noisy, very complex data, and how to extract the features that tell us, yes, this is the spot that's getting the right engagement of the DMN, and not this spot, which is more activating the dorsal attention network, for example.
How is the energy being administered? Is it just something worn in the head, or is it something deeper than that?
Yeah, well, TMS coils are like an MRI coil, but in miniature. It actually puts out about the same amount of energy. So it's 2.2 teslas of energy in a butterfly coil that's placed against the skull. Now, if you remember your physics, right, right-hand rule, when you flip a magnetic field, you induce current, right? That's the basis of electromagnetic energy. So when we do that, when we light up the coil in a microsecond, we release a huge burst of energy. It actually induces current in the brain, quite a bit of current, actually. We can sometimes see fields of up to 140 volts per meter. That's a lot of voltage, not current necessarily, but voltage in the brain. So a volume of tissue, roughly the size of a cubic centimeter, a volume of neurons fire. Hundreds of millions of neurons all fire where the coil is most concentrated, which is a few centimeters deep in the gray matter. So that is how we use this very powerful modality. And it is quite specific too. So you move just 1 centimeter up, right, left, or down, you could miss the network entirely. Uh-huh. And The dose, as I said before, too, the dose really changes depending on the excitability of the patient's brain and the atrophy of the patient's brain. Remember, Alzheimer's, your brain is atrophying. And so we have to account for that atrophy and crank up the power sometimes to be able to reach the deeper structures of an atrophied brain. But also, remember, the Alzheimer's brain is sometimes hyperexcitable. So to balance all these competing factors, that's why we personalize the dose. By, again, looking at TMS-CEG and looking at TMS-evoked potentials. That's how we personalize the dose.
How do you see this fitting into a treatment regimen? When provided you get approval, and we can get into that timeline in a moment, but is this something that's administered after a diagnosis or pre-diagnosis later on? Where would do you think this would be most beneficial?
All of our data to date has been generated in mild to moderate patients. It seems to work equally well in mild versus moderate patients. Uh-huh. And so we feel comfortable going after that patient population in our pivotal study. However, given that there's almost no downside to our therapy, which is a painless 20-minute-a-week therapy, given there's almost no downside, the worst thing that could happen to you is a mild headache that occurs in 1 in 10 patients. Given there's no downside, it makes sense to start as soon as possible. So think about the cancer therapeutic space. Why wait until you have stage 3 cancer to treat, right? You want to attack it as early as possible. Strengthen those networks in the brain before cognitive decline sets in. So that's why we believe, and what we hear from KOLs, every single one would administer our therapy the moment a patient is diagnosed. And now with the blood-based biomarkers, you can get a simple finger prick blood test that tells you if you have Alzheimer's pathology.
Wow.
So why would you wait, right? I would get the stimulation as soon as I knew that I had Alzheimer's pathology.
Yeah, I mean, if this were in place, my whole answer would have been, why would I want to know? If there's nothing you can do, I don't really want to even know I have the biomarker. If there's something that can be done, certainly that changes the game entirely.
And maybe there's a way to boost human memory, and maybe by boosting human memory, we can actually delay the onset of dementia. We have some tantalizing early data, and I say it's early. In healthy volunteers, we've been able to show that we can boost human memory in terms of long-term associative memory. The measure that we use is the face name association test, which is a validated endpoint of memory. It turns out that one stimulation session can boost long-term associative memory by quite a bit. So maybe there's a way to make this a prophylactic therapy that not only would boost your memory in your later age, but also delay the onset of dementia. This is all speculative. Uh-huh. We don't know. It's early. It's preliminary. But that's the promise of this kind of therapy in the long term. And, Alzheimer's is not the only dementia that we could focus on. There's others as well. But it's such a huge, holy grail of medicine. It makes sense to attack first and focus on. But I would like to see our therapy rolled out along the entire continuum of memory enhancement and memory preservation, dementia prevention, and also the treatment of Alzheimer's disease.
So where are you in your clinical development, and what does the next few years look like? And hopefully, when could you maybe hope to file for approval?
Well, given the strength of the phase 2 studies, the 2 that have been completed and published, we feel confident moving forward in a pivotal study. We've had many conversations with FDA on that. We see a pathway to approval that could put us on the market by 2028. That is fast.
Yeah.
We're not talking about a 10-year approval pathway for a drug with all kinds of unknown side effects. This is a very straightforward therapy. It's so safe. It's so established in terms of its rollout in depression that we can leverage the safety track record of these devices. Now, we do bring personalization and precision to the table. This is not the old TMS that we've seen for the last 15 years. This is new in terms of your ability to use this highly precise, highly tailored and targeted approach to stimulating the functional networks in the brain that are related to Alzheimer's. But, there's nothing that should prevent us from rolling this out by 2028. If all the stars align, we could be on the market by 2029. And my vision for us is to first roll this out to academic sites, which will be involved in our study, and then move on to private practice neurology groups. who knows, you know, maybe at one point there will be these centers on the corner of multiple blocks in your city across the nation. You know, that would be the vision, kind of like a DaVita or Fresenius model, uh-huh. You know, except that in the case of dialysis, it's about 2 to 3 hours twice per week. In our case, it's 20 minutes, painless stimulation. Keep your eyes open, talk to the technician, and it is a technician, and do your weekly therapy to maintain everything that makes life worth living.
That's amazing. Is this, would the regimen be prescribed by, what would be the clinical, what type of physician would you be engaging with? Who would be?
It's primarily neurology.
Neurology.
Yeah. There are geriatric physicians who focus on Alzheimer's and also some psychiatry that do as well. But primarily we're talking about neurologists. And we've spoken to many, as you might expect, they are thrilled to potentially have something that works. It works across the board, cognition, function, and behavior. It has almost no side effects. And here's the benefit, it can be combined with any drug as well. So we don't really see pharmaceuticals as in competition with us. We see them as potentially a layer on top of stimulation. You know, what better substrate for a drug than stimulation, given that there's almost no side effects and no downside to doing stimulation? So we see combination therapy as naturally evolving. We've had a lot of interest inbound on combining our stimulation with drugs. But yeah, it'll be a neurologist because these are complex patients. They've been handed a death sentence. Think about that.
Sure.
100% will die from Alzheimer's. So it is a very serious disease that requires very serious management. You have to make sure that you rule out any other causes of dementia. There are all kinds of other comorbid conditions that need to be looked at. So a neurologist has to be involved in this in one way or another. Given the blood test out there today, though, patients are showing up earlier and earlier with diagnoses, even before cognitive decline. So our vision, our hope is we can get those patients to therapy as soon as they get a diagnosis and preserve as much of their cognition as possible.
What's the cumulative effect of this? I mean, is this in 2030, if someone receives a diagnosis, they haven't shown any decline yet, they begin your treatment, they get it once every whatever months or year that they're supposed to. Do you anticipate that this can hold off serious decline, or is it just a slowing? What do you think?
Well, given the data so far, I'd be a little bit over my skis to say that we can stop the disease.
Sure.
87% slowing is pretty good.
Yeah, that's great.
But that's only on functionality, you know, and on other markers, it's a little less than that, but it's still years of additional life that we could give patients, 10 months back for every 12 months of stimulation. So, you know, maybe we give patients back 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years of additional quality of life.
Uh-huh.
That would be worth everything to me when I think about my grandmother. I mean, that would be, you know, 5 more Christmases that we could have with her where she actually is present and remembers who we are.
Yep.
That would be priceless. Patients can't wait for this, Tom. They just can't. I mean, I'm getting these calls from friends and family members pretty much on a weekly basis for people who are desperate. There are no approved therapies for moderate Alzheimer's. There's no option for these patients. They are absolutely desperate. We need to get this therapy out there as fast as possible.
And Ken, before I let you go, you know, this is a business that we're in, and these treatments are potentially miraculous, but the payers control sort of the spigot as to whether the folks can access it or not. What kind of feedback are you getting from the payer community regarding this treatment?
So Tom, I was on the buy side for a long time, and so I'm not naive when it comes to the realities of reimbursement and payment and coding and so forth. So knowing that, we started the process really early with Synaptica. And so we went in front of the CPT panel, and it took a while, but we got there. We got new codes. The codes are specific to what we do. They call for neuronavigation and TMS evoked potentials and automated data processing and calculation of optimal location and intensity, et cetera. So all those codes, those two codes are now going to come into approval. They are approved. They'll be active on January 1st. And it's really a way to de-risk the commercial pathway here. The codes could pay quite a bit and make this a very profitable therapy for neurologists. Think about what a neurologist faces with the drugs. I mean, they're very expensive drugs that they don't make any money on.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, dealing with some of the side effects from these drugs
yeah.
can be, you know, really debilitating and not a profit center. In fact, the opposite. So here, for the first time, we have a therapy we can offer to neurologists that could actually give them a whole new profit center that's not only a reason to adopt, but also, you know, can enable them to grow this practice and have more and more machines and treat more and more patients as they go. And then one other aspect of our therapy I failed to mention too is it has a built-in biomarker. So we're measuring the health of the DMN every few months. So we can actually give that physician a readout when we use that calibration code. We can give the physician a readout that enables them to tell their patient, hey, your brain is responding or not. Your brain is responding to this therapy. That is gold in terms of the confidence that gives a physician and the confidence that gives a patient to know that on an objective level, their brain is responding. So anyway, we're thinking through a lot of the aspects of commercialization here, and we think we're far ahead of the game in terms of thinking through the key pieces and reimbursement, coding, and coverage. I think we're well ahead of the game.
And will those codes be employed during your pivotal? Are you able to use it for that?
Great question. It's a little known fact, but some of your audience would know that sometimes you can use these codes to pay for aspects of your pivotal. We haven't made the choice to do that yet. There's some pros and cons to doing that. At Boston, we had the ability to do that with some of our DBS implants and new indications, for example. So we'll look at the option to do that here. Obviously, it could take a big chunk out of the cost of our pivotal.
Uh-huh.
I'm inclined to pursue it if it's viable, but we'll make that decision when we get there. The great news, though, for folks is that, you know, we're thinking through how to scale this, and that means making it available to as many patients as possible.
And the pros, I think, are obvious. What would the cons be? I'm curious if you don't mind sharing.
Well, yeah, so there is one con, which is if you have a mixed population of Medicare and non-Medicare, then the reimbursement will be different, and you want to maintain equipoise between the two groups. And there's also a lot of paperwork involved. And so you have to educate your sites on how to do the billing, and it has to be done right, and it slows you down. So those would be the only cons to it. So that's why I lean towards using the codes if we can.
Uh-huh.
It is up to CMS if they will cover. They've been, you know, incredibly flexible in the past, and other trials have been associated with in covering the, you know, developmental therapies. We'll see if that's the case here. I think there's a great reason to help us, though, given the need that's out there.
And I would think this would be almost primarily a Medicare population, right?
90%.
Yep. Okay. That's fantastic. Now, I, again, having been through this, you know, my mom didn't get to meet my younger son. So you're right. 3 or 4 years makes all the difference in the world. And to stay in your own home for that length of time, or even a support, an independent living sort of facility, not having to go into the clinical nursing home. It's, I think going in those homes just speeds the decline. So anything you can do to keep someone in a vibrant, independent community makes a lot of sense. So this is fantastic. I mean, this is why we talk about MedTech. These are the hopeful stories that we like to profile. So, Ken, thanks for giving us this, for sharing your story, and for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for the opportunity to share this story with you and your listeners. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks again to Interpower for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly podcast. We hope you will join us at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalk.com to register. We hope you'll join us next week at our Interventional Innovation Series. Super convenient. You don't have to leave your desk. Happens at noon every day. A nice little lunchtime break if you're on the East Coast. Or something to watch and participate in if you're getting warmed up on the West Coast. And, of course, anywhere in between Central and Mountain Time, we'd love to have you be part of it as well. So make sure you check that out. Again, you can watch it live or on demand. And that's it. Regarding the podcast, please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. Please connect with me. Connect with Kayleen Brown, our managing editor. Connect with Amir Weininger as well. And connect with Device Talks, so you don't miss a future episode of our commentary and of our podcast. And of course, you also subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network, so you have future episodes of our podcast sent directly to you. All right, folks, Once again, thanks for being a part of Device Talks. We look forward to a super fun, super strong, super interesting second half of 2025. Let's go.